The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now in graphic audio.
How far you reckon we are from St. Louis?
I'll be there in another week just about, I'd say.
That arm of yours gonna be good and healed up by then?
It's pretty much healed now. I can use it without any trouble. Just aches a little every now and then.
Well, you best be careful with it. You want to be at full strength when we get there. Killing that bastard Beaumont ain't going to be easy.
No, but it sure is going to be satisfying.
Pony! Everybody, hunch cuff!
Hey, Dugan, don't you reckon it's about time you tell me what we're doing here?
Hear that?
Yeah, what is it?
Steamboat round the bend. What gets here? That's when the shooting starts.
Beaumont! I'm coming for you, Beaumont, you goddamn coward! I'm gonna skin you alive!
The First Mountain Man 16, Preacher's Fire. Available now in graphic audio.
Graphic audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's A Town Called Fury by William W. Johnstone with J.A. Johnstone. Narrated by Thomas Penny. With performances by Danny Gavigan, Terrence Aselford, Sherry Simpson, Christopher Graybill, Tim Getman, Tim Carlin, David Coyne, Casey Platt, Michael Glenn, Elizabeth Demery, Andy Clements, Mort Shelby, Sonny Lasky, Kate Foster, Stephen Carpenter, Richard Rowan, James Konacek, M.B. Van Dorn, Nanette Savard, Ren Casey, Dylan Lynch, Ken Jackson, and Elizabeth Jernigan.
Kansas City, Missouri, 1865. Jedediah Fury put down his paintbrush and bucket of whitewash, struck a match on the sole of his dusty boot, then set it to his pipe. Puffing in the sweet smoke, he sat down on a bale of straw and looked out over his future. More like what his future had been reduced to. He saw a house in town, small compared to the one he'd left behind back east, but still neat and tidy. Three good saddle geldings enclosed by the corral fence he'd just finished whitewashing half of. A milk cow in the tiny barn that had come with the place, a handful of clucking, pecking hens, a few newly purchased stoats, presently rooting and quarreling in their pen, and his old short-bed Conestoga wagon, the one that had made so many trips from the East Coast to the Western Shore and back again. He really ought to figure out just how many miles he'd put under those wheels, he thought. Or maybe not. He wasn't exactly sure he wanted to know how much time, how much blood, sweat, tears, and effort he'd put into guiding pilgrims into the wilderness over the past 20 years. Well, not much the last few. Of course, people had wanted to go west, be shown the way, but he'd been more than a little preoccupied with the war. He'd given it his heart and his soul, not to mention two sons and and a wife. His only remaining boy, Jason, had almost caught up with him on the other side of the fence. Jason carefully opened the gate and let himself out, placing his brush and paint bucket alongside his father's. He didn't join his father, however. He went to the pump and began to wash his hands.
Nice job, son.
Yeah, that looks good. Your side too, Paul.
Everything was grudging with that boy. Although he reminded himself that Jason was 20, not a boy any longer. At 20, Jedediah had been trapping beaver and wolf in the Colorado Territory with Wash Keough. No, 20 was no boy.
Jason, after you finish up there, could you hike over to the Mercantile and pick up a few pounds of flour for your sister?
Finally, Jason twisted his head around. He just splashed his face with water and it was dripping.
Flour? What for?
Your sister's making dinner.
Jason's mother, Jane, had always said that Jeremy had all the enthusiasm of the three, Jonathan had all the sweetness, and Jason had the good looks that would lead him either to prison or the U.S. Senate. She'd been right, Jedediah figured. Jeremy, their eldest, had been so damn eager to please his senior officer that he'd led his squadron on a suicide mission into the swamps of Georgia and had died right along with the rest of them. As for his youngest, Jonathan, well, the boy had been too kind-hearted for his own good, God bless him. One afternoon, he'd invited a party of travelers to come in for some of his ma's good cooking, which was nothing that he hadn't seen his pa do countless times before. But what Jonathan didn't know that day was that the very fellows he'd invited into the parlor were the same four that had, not 3 hours before, held up a bank down in Maryland and shot two men. They killed the boy and his mother before leaving the house. Little Jenny survived, but only because she had the sense to run and hide out back in the woods.
Oh, Pa, why'd you want to go and let Jenny cook again? Last time...
We all have our unfortunate accidents, Jason. Don't go mentioning it in front of her.
Why not?
It hurts her feelings.
Jason wasn't paying him any mind. His eyes were focused up toward the street instead. Jedediah followed his son's gaze to a small contingent of people marching up the gravel driveway. Could this mean a new trip to the wild country? He stood up and walked forward.
Afternoon, folks.
Don't get started yet. They might only be trying to get us to join the Baptist church.
The tall man at the front of the group came right up to him and stuck out his hand, taking Jedediah's and pumping it vigorously.
Mr. Fury, sir.
Yes?
I'm the Reverend Milsha, Lewis Milsha, that is. And this is my wife, Lavinia.
Reverend, ma'am, pleased to make your acquaintance. What can I do for you folks?
I have been voted spokesman for our group, Mr. Fury. We are only 8 wagons and a small gather of livestock, but I am certain that we can attract a few more fellow pilgrims. When it's known that we have procured the great Jedediah Fury as our wagon master.
Where are you folks planning on ending up?
Why, California, sir.
Whereabouts in California?
I plan to go to Southern California. I have already purchased land there in a place outside the town of Los Angeles. Have you heard of it?
Why don't you folks step on into the house? You go run that errand for your sister, Jason.
Oh, my! What a handsome young man.
Thank you. I reckon he's a good enough boy.
Jason walked the 4 blocks down into the beginning of the business district and headed for the nearest dry goods store. He wasn't any too fond of Missouri, or Kansas City for that matter. If he'd had his druthers, he'd have stayed back east and gone to college the way his folks had always promised him he would. But the war hadn't been their fault after all. Although he would have liked very much to blame them, or at least his father. And there was no money. Even the sale of their old family property had barely paid off their debts. He supposed he should be grateful that his father had an established trade of sorts to fall back on. But Jason wasn't very grateful. All he could think of was those ivied halls that he'd never see. And the only thing he could feel was cheated and envious and hurt.
Let me alone, you big bully! Stop it!
Quit your whining, you little sissy!
As he made his way along the street, he heard voices from down an alley at his left. He stopped and looked, and there in the shadows, saw a fist fight in progress. One of the fellows in it was quite a bit smaller and was suffering the brunt of it. Never one to just mind his own business, as his father was fond of reminding him, Jason stepped into the alley's mouth.
Hey, there, you. Let him go.
The bigger fellow, one hand on the smaller's collar, turned his head toward Jason and smiled. It was a very unwholesome smile.
Get lost!
He slugged the smaller boy again. Neither of them was past 21. The smaller boy lost consciousness and slipped to the ground.
And just what business is it of yours, Mr. Fancy Pants?
Get out. Go on home.
Just who the hell do you think you are, anyhow?
I'm someone who doesn't like to see murder committed for no reason but sport.
The bully appeared taken aback and said nothing for a moment, giving Jason the time to notice the initials MM embroidered on one point of his collar, and that he also wore not just one gun, which Jason had seen from the first, but two.
Go on. Don't be stupid.
Stupid?
He suddenly ran toward Jason. Jason sidestepped him at the last moment, and the bully's momentum took him out into the street and right into a mud puddle.
God damn it, son of a bitch!
While the bully was picking himself up, Jason went to his victim and helped him to his feet.
Thank you. Be careful. That's Matt McDonald.
The bully was bearing down on Jason again, although he was slightly impeded by the mud soaking his pants and shirt, and the fact that he'd stepped into a bucket and it was stuck on one foot. He'd also lost one gun. His first wild swing caught Jason square in the chest and sent him stumbling backward into a stack of crates. Jason rolled and came up on his feet fast. The bully was caught off guard. Jason clipped him on the side of the head. Matt staggered. A sharp uppercut laid the bully out flat, with his foot still stuck in that bucket.
Gosh!
Duck your head in that rain barrel water. You got blood on your face. You don't want to scare your folks.
The boy obeyed, and he and Jason walked out of the alley, leaving a cowed Matt McDonald behind.
What's your name, kid?
Milcher. Thomas Milcher. And I'm not a kid. I'm 15.
Sorry. Your papa a reverend?
Yeah, what about it?
Stick close, then. I gotta pick up something, then I'm going home. Your folks are there.
Jason headed up the street again in search of a dry goods store, with young Thomas Milcher tagging at his heels. Jedediah was satisfied with the group clustered about his big dining room table and packed into the corners of the room. Seven couples in all, they were a good start on a wagon train. The Reverend Milcher had done most of the talking, but Jedediah had been able to pick up a few things about the others. Hamish McDonald was looking to become a rancher. At least he had announced at least three times that he had a dozen cows with calves at their sides and a prime Hereford bullock and four nice Morgan mares and was looking for land. He didn't care where, so long as there was good grazing. McDonald, a widower, also had a boy, 20, and a girl, 16. Young Randall Nordstrom had no children, but his wife, Miranda, was a seamstress, and he had a wagon load of foodstuffs and yard goods and gewgaws. They were planning on opening a store, with Miranda doing sewing and giving music lessons on the side. There were two Morton families. Well, three. Ezekiel and his wife, Eliza, had two grown daughters who were also traveling with them. Electa was single and 27. Europa was 30 and was now Mrs. Milton Griggs. And Milton was a blacksmith and a wheelwright. They used up two wagons between them. The other part of the Morton family was elderly Zachary Morton, a gunsmith, and his wife, Susanna. They had no children, at least with them, and Jedediah had first thought that they were too old to make the trip. However, the Reverend Milcher had managed to convince him otherwise, and Zachary looked fit for his age. He sat at the far end of the table, glowering from beneath his gray and beetling brows while he fiddled with his pipe. Next came Salmon Kendall and his wife Cordelia. They hailed from Massachusetts and were farmers. While Salmon had no special skills or merchandise upon which the train could count, he looked to have a strong back and a solid purpose. They had two children, Salmon Jr., called Sammy, 12, and Peony, called for some inexplicable reason Piney, age 10. The Milchers themselves, he supposed, offered spiritual aid. the Reverend and his wife, Lavinia, had 7 kids ranging from 5 to 15. The wife seemed to have a bit of a harpy's tongue, but he supposed all those children would keep her busy. At least he hoped so. Altogether, the 5 families, counting all the Mortons as one, accounted for 8 long and short bed Conestoga wagons, 9 saddle horses and 4 breeding stock, a couple dozen cattle, assorted hogs, goats, 2 dogs, and a cat named Chuckles, which belonged to the Milchers. It was a fine start.
Well,
6 or 8 additional wagons, anyway.
Where on earth can we find as many as we already are, Ezekiel?
I shouldn't think it'd be too difficult, Liza. After all, ain't Kansas City the great jumping-off place, darling?
Over the next few weeks, the wagon train grew and grew. Jedediah found a group of 6 wagons to join up, and the Reverend Milcher found 2, then 5, then 7. Milchers were mostly farmers, but within the ranks of Jedediah's recruits were some folks he considered quite useful. Michael Morelli was a country doctor. Well, not the go-to-school kind, but he was close enough. He, his wife Olympia, and their young son Constantine and younger daughter Helen would journey complete with a traveling surgery, something that Jedediah knew from hard experience would come in handy. In addition, he picked up Saul and Rachel Cohen and their boys David, Jacob, and Abraham. The Cohens were Jews, and he expected some trouble from the Reverend Milcher along the line, but he figured he'd put up with it. The Cohens planned to open a store once they got to California and brought 2 wagons to the mix, one of which would be filled to the brim with stock for the new mercantile. True, the Nordstroms were well-stocked too, but most of their stuff was yard goods and notions and the like, while the Cohens carried hardware and hand tools. If forced to choose, Jedediah would rather have had the Cohens along any day of the week. The rest of his recruits were farmers or potential ranchers, although Seth Wheeler had done some smithing in his time, or so he said. The best he could say for Milcher's new folks was that one of the women had been a nurse during the war. But still, he was glad for the bodies and the wagons. He thought they had enough now. Arrangements were made, money changed hands, wagons were packed and repacked and loaded, and spirits were high. Always best to start off that way, Jedediah thought. The reality of the trip would take the wind out of their sails, but at least they were inflated with bright and airy hopes to start with. That way, they had a lot farther to fall before they hit bottom. As for himself, well, Jason was going with him, and Jenny was staying behind with Tom and Sally Norton, their neighbors, until he got back next year. Jedediah had arranged it all, but Jenny wasn't having it, drat her. Right this minute, she stood before him in the front hall, her arms crossed over her chest, just like her mama, and a frown on her face.
But I want to come. I am coming.
Jenny, I'll have no more of this. I told you, you're only 15, and it's a long, hard trip.
I know how old I am, Papa, and I know it's hard. But the boys got to go when they were only 12. And don't say that they were boys.
Honey, they were boys. It makes a difference. You're just a young thing, learning to cook and bake and sew like your mama. Someday you'll want to keep house for your man, and you'll want to keep it in a civilized place, not out on the wild prairie. Boys don't grow on trees out there.
Papa, I'll be safe. After all, you and Jason will be there. Why, I could get shot by a bandit or kidnapped into a house of degradation right here in Kansas City.
What about school?
Oh, radishes, Papa. I spoke with Miss Morton, and she says I can help her. I've already got my 8th grade certification, as if you didn't know.
All right, Jenny, you wore me down. You can go along, I reckon, but you'll have to do your share, just like anybody else. You'll walk behind the wagon, do the cooking, and help with the livestock. You'll have to learn to reload in case there's trouble, you know.
I'd rather you taught me how to shoot.
Don't press your luck, daughter.
Jedediah rode the half mile down to the Reverend Milcher's current place of residence, the double lot behind Barker's Laundry, on his old blue roan saddle horse, Gumption. Milcher and several of his group had set up temporary camp there, and Barker was charging them a pretty penny for the pleasure. Milcher saw him coming and lifted a hand.
Hail, Brother Fury!
Morning, Milcher. How are your folks coming along? Ready to go in the morning?
Indeed, indeed. We could leave this evening if you desire.
Tomorrow will be soon enough.
Jedediah cast a gaze toward the corral, where there stood a number of milk cows, horses, oxen, and goats.
Say, where's Hamish McDonald's livestock?
Oh, he's moved them out to graze, somewhere north of town. They'll be back in time, though, I hope.
Those cows of yours could use a little grass. They'll get some starting tomorrow, though.
My opinion, exactly.
Where's Jason? I don't see him.
He went to load the water barrel wagon. He and Matt McDonald and Milton Griggs.
Well, then, let me help you with those crates, Milcher.
Be obliged, Brother Fury.
Jason sat his mare on the far bank of the Missouri, mopping his brow. Who would have thought it would take this long to get them all across? But only two of the ferries were operational. The cattle had decided to go downstream a mile before crossing all the way over, and the Milcher's cat had developed a sudden urge to go swimming. He thought one of their kids had likely tossed the cat over the side, but he kept his peace and fished the poor thing out of the drink. He'd like to get his hands on that kid, though. The cattle had been brought back upstream by his father's three hired men, Milk Billings, who Jason was surprised his father had hired, because Jason didn't trust him any further than he could throw him, Gil Collins, who at 24 was the youngest of the three, and something of a cipher, and Ward Wanamaker. Jason liked Ward. He was good with livestock, good with people, and seemed to be looking forward to the journey. The men were holding the cattle in a tight group about 100 yards from where Jason sat as Palomino, watching the final wagon roll off the ferry. Later on, the three would serve as jacks of all trades, everything from Indian fighters to roustabouts to baby walkers. Farther out ahead, his father was lining up the rest of the wagons, making sure everybody had made it across the river high and dry. Jason doubted the Milcher's cat was faring as well as the rest of the Milchers. He looked for Jenny, too, and spied her, the third wagon from the front, high on the driver's bench of the family Conestoga. He couldn't help but quirk his mouth up into a smile. He'd bet she hadn't figured on driving a six in hand when she begged her way into this. Well, she'd be walking soon enough. His father had brought along extra trade goods this time, and all those mirrors and blankets and gewgaws weighed as much as two fat steers. And that was in addition to their personal things. He'd also brought extra ammunition in a wagon currently driven by Tommy Milcher, and another filled with extra water for the livestock. Ward Wanamaker had left the livestock and was presently taking the ferry back to drive it over. Jenny'd have to get out and lead their team sooner or later. His father would insist. On the road west, horses and oxen were more important than people, unless you were starving to death. And even then, it was iffy. He'd noticed that the Reverend Milcher, in addition to all those kids, had brought along a piano, probably to accompany all the hymns he'd be leading in that new church he planned to build. Jason figured that piano would probably end up somewhere beside the trail about halfway into the Indian territory, as would the Nordstrom's big old brake front and Milton Griggs's anvil. People brought the craziest things along. Jason reined his horse around while taking a last, longing look at the eastern horizon. Goodbye to college, good fellowship, and good things. Hello, tumbleweeds and wild country, and sudden death. Well, his path was set now, in the hot, dry Caliche, baking sun of the land to come. He'd just have to live with it. He gave the men a friendly wave to move up the herd, then goosed his horse into a slow lope and caught up with the plodding wagons up front. Ten miles from the Missouri, and Lavinia was already having second thoughts about that piano. Lewis had purchased it secondhand in Missouri, and it had seemed like a good idea at the time. Music to bring the godless back to the fold. Silky songs of praise to unite the congregation into one big family. But it weighed too much. It took up the room where three of their children could have slept, and Lavinia had left behind 100 pounds of flour and another 50 of cornmeal to make room. She was happy to defer to her lord and master, but not when he was being an idiot. And only an idiot would cast her children outside to sleep beneath the wagon with the snakes. It was bad enough that they had to walk behind or alongside the wagon, that they'd have to stay there for, what,
1,500 miles? 2,000? They had been mad to give in to Lewis's wanderlust, mad to leave their comfortable farm and their rightful place in society. Lewis had insisted there was more, though. Greener pastures, he'd said. If only his greener pastures weren't so very far away. And now, here she was, only 10 miles into the wilderness, with stinging feet and throbbing thighs and aching calves and ankles swollen like the fabled elephants. Her head hurt, her eyes burned, and she could only imagine what her children were feeling. At least Seth, at 12, had been deemed mature enough and lightweight enough to do the driving. Her littlest, Hope, rode beside him on the bench, and her next-to-youngest, Charity, clung to her hand and bravely tried to keep up, although Lavinia carried her half the time. Young Thomas drove one of the communal wagons for Mr. Fury, but the rest of the children walked. She felt a rivulet of sweat make its way down her back underneath the stays of her corset. Perhaps Susanna Morton had been right. This was no place for the niceties of society. And it was no place for these shoes. The blisters rising on her heels, she stopped, putting Charity on the ground beside her. Charity didn't understand and held up her arms with a pleading look. Lavinia shook her head.
Mother's feet are sore, darling. She can't carry you any longer until they're bandaged. Run and ask your brother to let you ride on the wagon with Hope.
Yes, Mother.
Charity scampered off ahead. Lavinia stood exactly where she had stopped for some time, letting wagon after wagon pass her, group after group of walking women and children, until the Morelli's wagon came into view. She didn't know the Morellis very well, since they were Catholic and her husband frowned on papists, but she knew that he was a doctor, and that was what she needed. She waved at him, up there in the driver's seat.
Dr. Morelli! Dr. Morelli, I have a medical problem!
Morelli slowed the wagon, then pulled out of line and stopped completely.
Mrs. Milcher, what seems to be the problem?
My feet!
Morelli slipped an arm around her and helped her hobble to his wagon.
Oh, those are no shoes for walking, Mrs. Milcher. Does one of your boys have a spare pair of boots?
Boots?
Yes, good, sturdy, roomy boots.
Dr. Morelli was already at work with the button hook. What he produced when he pulled off her shoe shocked her. She had thought she was blistered only on her heels, for they hurt the worst. But instead, her foot was a mass of blisters, bruises, and contusions. Morelli removed the other shoe. He looked up and gave her a stern frown.
Women, you lame yourself for fashion.
Then he handed over her shoes and got to work with antiseptic and bandages. When he was finished, he lifted her onto the wagon's tailgate.
Stay put, you hear? I don't want you on your feet for at least 2 days. I'll drive you up to your own rig.
Cowed and embarrassed, Lavinia Milcher simply nodded. When they circled the wagons late that afternoon, Lavinia Milcher wasn't the only walking wounded. 3 other women and girls had so damaged their feet that they'd have to ride for the next few days. Earlier in the day, young Jacob Cohen had made the mistake of trying to play with the Milcher kids and had taken a beating for his trouble.
Dizzy.
Hey, you little whelps! Leave him alone, or I'll give all your hides a tan and you won't soon forget.
Let's get out of here!
Come on, Jacob, they're gone. Let's get you back to your ma.
Jason, torn between drowning the lot of the Milcher kids or just poleaxing their father, had to settle for hollering at them. He hoisted the battered and weeping 8-year-old Jacob up into his saddle. Fortunately, the Cohens were traveling right in front of Doc Morelli's wagon, and Mrs. Cohen whisked the boy back to the doctor before Jason had a chance to apologize for those idiot Milchers. She abandoned her wagon entirely, and Jason had to take over the driving for about half an hour. He honestly didn't know how anybody could take sitting on those damn seats all day. By the time she got back with a bandaged Jacob in tow, Jason's backside had bruises on its bruises. He was glad to turn the rig over and get back up on Cleo again. After that torturous ride, the Palomino's smooth gait seemed like heaven.
Oh,
By the time everybody was in place and the wagons were circled for the night, the sun had slipped beneath the horizon. Men turned to stripping the harness off their horses and oxen, and the women started to fix dinner. Jason had a few words with his father, telling him of the Cohen-Milcher battle.
Figured it'd happen. Just didn't figure so soon. You did the right thing, Jason. I'll take care of it. Don't know why these folks can't just get along for as long as it takes to make the Galdern trip.
The livestock was put up, dinner was prepared, a fire had been built in the center of the circled wagons, and most folks sat around it, plates in their weary hands. Jedediah stood up slowly, dreading his speech. He walked over to the fire.
Folks, can I have your attention? Just wanted to say a few things. First off, y'all did real well for a first day on the trail. We made 12 miles by my reckoning. Of course, that was all on the flat. We won't do as well later on. But by the same token, some days we'll do better. Now, most of you know that I hired us some help for the drive. Milt Billings, stand up there, Milt, is an ace horseman. He speaks Paiute, Comanche, Crow, and Apache. And that's going to come in mighty handy. We're going to need to trade with the natives, and that takes communication, folks. Next, there's Ward Wanamaker and Gil Collins. Ward, doff your hat so they can tell who's who. Ward and Gil are both as good with their guns as they are with livestock or a shovel. You get into a bind and need somebody to help you with your livestock, or you need a spare driver for a spell, you call on Ward or Gil. And sit down, boys. Now, there's something else that's been preying on my mind. Folks, we've all throwed in together in order to make this difficult trip across the wilderness. And that means leaving our petty bigotries behind us. We've got somebody from practically everywhere in the world in our group. Folks from the north and folks from the south, folks from the old country and the new, Protestants, Catholics, and Jews. Now, I heard about some trouble breaking out today, which is pretty damn soon for trouble. You parents, you school your youngins to be more tolerant, else you're going to be in for a world of hurt. Everybody got that?
The group was shocked into silence, which he'd hoped would be their reaction. Jedediah made his way back to his place and sat down between Jason and Jenny.
Good dinner, honey.
Jenny started the next day as she had started the day before. After she got herself ready, she piled every blanket and quilt she owned on the driver's bench, then waited while her papa and Jason hitched the team. It was beyond her how those other drivers made do without padding. Jason must have seen her padding her perch because he actually smiled at her, something he didn't do very often.
Smart girl.
It was enough to plaster a smile on her face for the next 2 hours. By that time, they had made another 4 or 5 miles, and her papa had ridden down the line, saying that there was a town about 6 miles up the trail. Jenny knew that could mean only one thing. They'd camp outside it, and some of them would be able to go in and visit. Or buy things. Megan McDonald, who was fast becoming her best friend, had told her there'd be gooseberries ahead, or so she thought, and ever since, Jenny had been set on getting hold of some canning jars and paraffin. The Nordstroms had some in their spare wagon, but the cost was too dear. Well, she'd show them. She'd slip into town and get her own. The trip, meanwhile, was baking hot. She was glad she'd worn her bonnet. It kept the sun off her face anyway, but she knew her hands were turning brown as walnuts. Papa had given her driving gloves, but the reins were so soft and old that she hadn't needed them. Until now. She began to dig through her bag.
Hello?
Jenny smiled and turned to spy Megan, walking up alongside the wagon.
Hello yourself. Want a ride? You sure? I mean, that it's not too much load? Don't be silly. Besides, I need to find my driving gloves. All right.
Megan placed her foot on the step, swung up into the seat beside Jenny, who handed her the reins.
You're not blistering. No, but my hands will be as dark as a red Indian pretty soon.
Although Jenny was 2 years Megan's junior, the two had hit it off right away. Megan was nothing like her overbearing father or her bully of a brother. Jenny had decided within 3 minutes of their first meeting. She had all the humor in the family and a cleverness to match. And besides, both girls had lost their mothers at an early age. They were fast becoming sisters in spirit. And Jenny had seen Jason watching Megan. Not overtly, it wasn't Jason's style, but just in quick glances. He appeared to like what he saw, and Jenny was glad. Perhaps if she was lucky and said her prayers faithfully, Megan could become her sister in more than spirit. She hadn't broached the subject to Megan, though. That would have been bad luck. Jenny pulled on the first glove. They were men's gloves, and she swam in them.
Like what you done to the seat?
Don't know why everybody didn't think of it.
Oh, they will before too long, if you know what I mean.
Jenny followed Megan's gaze up the line, where Europa Griggs could be seen, fresh from driving duty, rubbing her backside as she limped along.
Guess so.
Up ahead, Jason had more pressing matters on his hands. Salmon Kendall's wagon had run over a rock, a big one, and broken an axle. Jason had the Kendalls unpacking their wagon, and Jedediah had hastened the other wagons in the train around the Kendalls in order to keep the time lost to a minimum. Jason was helping Kendall lighten the load while he waited for the Griggs' wagon or the Wheelers to arrive. At least, Seth Wheeler had said he'd done some blacksmithing and wheel riding in the past, and Milton Griggs was a smithy. Jason hoped that included some axle work, too. When the Morellis passed them, Doc hollered out,
"Can I help, Jason?"
Jason waved them past. That was all they needed, a wagon falling on their only medical man. He noticed that the McDonald's passed them by without a word. That figured. Then the Milchers' wagon passed them.
Good day to you, Brother Fjord.
The Nordstroms offered their help, but not so much as a look from Hamish McDonald or Matthew, who actually could have been of some help. But no, he just rode that big, flashy Pinto of his right on past, as if Jason and the Kendalls and half their cargo, spread out in the grass, weren't there at all. Bastard. When the boys driving the cattle and horses came up close, Ward Wanamaker rode over and pitched in. Together, he and Jason and Salmon got the wagon unloaded at just about the time that Seth Wheeler drove his team up.
Can I be of some help?
Wagon's got a busted axle, Seth. I'm hoping you can do something about it.
Yeah, let me take a look.
After 5 minutes of peering from various angles, he stood erect.
Can't fix her, but I can shore her up long enough to make the town. Your papa said there was a town not too far off, right?
Sure did.
Good. Don't suppose anybody in this train has an anvil. And supplies?
Milton Griggs does, I'm pretty sure. He's coming up now.
Through the dust came the Griggs wagon, with an uncomfortable Milton driving, his lank blonde hair flopping beneath his hat. Jason flagged him down and explained the problem. He and Milton Seth wrestled the anvil out of the back of the wagon.
You're lucky this thing didn't go straight through the bed.
Bottom's reinforced iron.
The whole thing?
Jason wondered that the horses could haul it. That is, until he took another look at the team. They were Belgian draft horses, as big and muscular as the man who owned them.
Whole thing. If somebody get a fire going, got my bellows and stuff in here somewhere.
Not much to it, Mr. Griggs. We just got to strap her together with some iron. They can replace the axle when we get to the town, I hope. This thing's pretty much shot.
Yeah, call me Milt. Let's get that fire going. Come on, boys. Somebody dig me a pit.
Salmon Kendall's wagon, jerry-rigged axle and all, fell into last place in the train an hour later. His load had been split out between Milt Griggs and Seth Wheeler and Saul Cohen's extra rig, and the wagon slowly limped along, eventually catching up with the others. Jedediah rode back to see how they were doing and was pleased to see that Jason had handled the situation.
How's that axle look?
Not good. They'll have to replace it once we get to town. Either that or buy a whole new rig. If I didn't know different, I'd swear that Conestoga of Kendall's was 100 years old. Damn thing's full of dry rot.
Idiots.
Jason knew exactly what he meant and didn't reply. They pulled into the tiny prairie farming community of Bliss, Kansas, just as the sun was setting. Jedediah ordered the wagons lined up along the outskirts of the tiny town,
and the herd bedded down farther out. Jason rode in ahead to see if they had a carter or a smithy who could either fix the wagon or replace it. He was hoping for the first, and he knew Salmon Kendall was too. Wagons cost dear, and Salmon didn't look as if he was any too flush. He'd sweated all through the repair work, and Jason was pretty sure it wasn't from the heat. He found Bliss livery right off, and as it turned out, he was in luck. The proprietor had nothing of the sort handy, but he knew of some folks that had come out from Iowa not too long ago, and they were trying to sell their wagon. When Jason tracked them down, it turned out they were just as willing to sell the whole shebang as the rear axle. He guessed they weren't doing too well by the look of them. He rode the Palomino out to meet Salmon Kendall and directed him out to the wagon, then sent Milton Griggs after him just in case. They might need another pair of strong shoulders, and frankly, Jason wasn't up to it. He'd yanked his neck, back, and shoulder clear out of kilter back there while they were shoring up the axle. So far, he'd managed to hide it from his father and the others, who wanted a ramrod who busted his own body during the first days out. But right now, all Jason wanted was a hot bath in town to soak in for maybe 6 or 8 hours. That, and about a quart of liniment. Jason wasn't accustomed to hurting himself. Oh, he'd been shot during the war, but that had been an accident, a friendly fire, seeing as how he was attached to the Department of War in Washington. Just a glorified paper pusher, that's all he'd been. Not a hero like his brother, butchered in the swamps of Georgia, or a hero like his father, who'd spent the last few months of the war in that hellhole, Andersonville Prison. No, just a pen pusher, a paper shuffler, a requisitions expert. A big, fat nothing. The man who'd shot him was a private, cleaning his mostly-for-show service pistol in the next office over. Life wasn't fair, Jason thought grimly, as he rode into town and found the barbershop. No, sir, just wasn't fair at all. Jedediah was sitting down to his supper and wondering what the devil had become of his son when he heard a wagon rolling in and saw Salmon Kendall on the driver's bench. Salmon reined in the team and jumped down, a grin splitting his face.
Well, what do you think, Mr. Fury? Isn't she grand?
He swept an arm back toward the big Conestoga, which was quite obviously a different rig than the one he'd been limping along in.
Why, I think she's a beauty, Salmon.
Mr. Kroger, the man with the wagon, he and his folks are having hard times. Said that if he couldn't sell the wagon, they were going to burn it for firewood this winter. Wouldn't sell just the axle. So, I traded him. My wagon for his. And I threw in a hog for good measure. What do you think of that?
That's fine, right fine. Griggs look her over for you?
Yes, indeed. And he pronounced her trailworthy. A good deal better than my other rig, he said later on. I mean, after we left the Kroger place. Why, he said my old rig was full of dry rot.
Happens. You'd best get your things unloaded from the other folks' wagons and into your own, before they start to take a dislike to you, though.
Certainly. Certainly.
You haven't seen my boy, have you?
Not since about 5. He rode off toward town.
Yeah!
Papa?
What, Jenny?
What's Jason doing in town all this time?
I'm sure he's got a good reason, honey. Now serve me up some more of that cornmeal mush.
Cornbread, Papa, cornbread.
Jason was slouched in the steaming tub, half asleep, his back and shoulder having already been tremendously eased, when the voice broke into his consciousness.
You the wagon man?
He opened one eye, surprised to hear the female voice in the men's bathing house, but not entirely shocked by it. During the war, even lowly paper pushers were welcome in Washington's bordellos. And it was precisely the tone of voice he'd expect to hear in one of those places, too. The woman standing at the doorway was dressed like a saloon girl. Probably was one, too, in those bright green spangles. And all that red hair piled up on her head. She couldn't be much older than he was, even under all that makeup. Which she didn't really need, he caught himself thinking. He opened the other eye.
Yes, I guess I am, Miss...
Miss Crimp. Abigail Crimp. And you are?
Jason Fury, miss. And may I ask what brings you here, Miss Abigail Crimp?
Oh, my man would have come, but he was busy, sorta. So he sent me.
About what?
About joining up.
With the wagon train.
Well, of course. Oh, you're a handsome devil, ain't you? Well, we want to go to California, me and Rome. It'd be nice having you along for scenery the whole way.
And Rome is?
My man, you fool. The one playing cards up at the Red Garter.
Now, Jason didn't have anything against gamblers personally, but he knew his father did. Jedediah vowed quite often, as a matter of fact, that they were all larcenous ne'er-do-wells, and he wouldn't have one within 5 miles of any of his wagons.
I'm afraid you'll have to find yourself a different party to join, Miss Crimp.
Why?
Because my pa is in charge, not me. And he doesn't take to gamblers of any sort. Or fancified ladies.
But there hasn't been a wagon train through here in 2 years. They all go down through Hastings.
Then I suggest you get yourselves down to Hastings, wherever that is.
Well, I guess that handsome is as handsome does is the truth after all. Thank you very much, and good luck with your journey.
Thanks, Miss Abigail. I'll probably be needing it, sooner or later. Women. Are they all crazy, or is it just the ones I run into?
Roman Lefebvre sat back and watched the rube in the blue shirt scrape up the pot. Rome's having a bad night, and he should have bowed out of the game a good hour ago. Really, should have gotten out years ago. But if a man was born stubborn, he couldn't help but hold on to it. He was going to have to let go, though. All he had left was the $100 bill pinned inside his vest, and he'd need that to pay the hotel bill and get the rig out of hock down at the livery. He was saved from having to ante up again by Abigail's entrance into the saloon.
You'll please pardon me, gentlemen.
He stood immediately when she stepped in, bowed out of the game, and made his way over to her through the crowd. But when he got to her, she didn't have good news for him. He knew it by the look on her face.
It wasn't my fault, Rome.
Abigail fell back against the bar.
Rome, it wasn't my fault. I tell you, it wasn't my fault.
Rome raised his hand again, but this time withheld it when she cowered.
Get packed, everything. Swipe the hotel linens, too.
Where you going?
To do some business.
Midnight at the sleepy line of wagons, and Salmon Kendall was still too excited to sleep. Carefully, he slipped from under the drowsing Cordelia's arms and crept from the wagon, careful not to wake the children. The night air was cool and crisp, so cool that he almost needed a jacket. He would have gone back up for it, too, except he saw a fire still burning down the line. Someone else couldn't sleep either. He headed for it. Perhaps they'd have a spare cup of coffee. To his surprise, he found Saul Cohen crouched near the fire, intently gazing into a small book. Cohen looked up.
Evening, Mr. Kendall.
Evening, Mr. Cohen. May I?
Sit. Ah. And what keeps you from sleep this night?
My new wagon. Still can't believe it.
Why not? All the way since Maryland, we've seen them rotting in the fields. Once a man has got to where he's going, he doesn't have much use for a Conestoga. Unless, of course, he's in the freight business. So, you'd like coffee?
Oh, yes, please, Mr. Cohen, if you wouldn't mind.
My name is Saul.
And I'm Salmon. Well, I suppose I ain't the best businessman. I'm just happy I got the problem solved. Mr. Griggs said my old wagon would have just disintegrated before we got to Colorado.
Dry rot?
How'd you know?
It's a gift. You are a brave one. Coming to drink coffee with me, even in the middle of the night. Don't you think that Milcher will be cursing your milk cow tomorrow?
We only have the one, and he's a bull.
Still, he would try to curse him. Or maybe your chickens.
Why?
Salmon, my friend, don't you know that I am a Jew?
You are? But we used to live down the road from some Cohens, and their people came from Ireland.
Cohen, Cohan, so much difference one little vowel makes.
Well, I'll be dogged. I'll be double dogged. Oh, that Milcher's an idiot. Between you and me, I don't even think he's a real man of God.
I'm inclined to agree. Sometimes on these old Conestogas, the linchpins give out. You have a problem like that, you come see Saul Cohen. I'm no good for axles, but linchpins I can replace. And for you, wholesale.
Thank you, Saul. I'll keep that in mind. That chicken your wife fried up for my family tonight, it was right good. I'd like you to thank her for me. Those potato things were real tasty, too.
It was for her own happiness. She knew all your family's cooking things were spread out in the other wagons. Besides, you go to all the trouble to kill one chicken kosher, you might as well kill two. Oh, and of course, they were your hens. We should be thanking you.
Sal and Kendall, what are you doing out here in the middle of the night?
Salmon jumped a little at the sound of his wife Cordelia's voice. She stood cloaked in her old wrapper, her night braid looped over her shoulder, glowering at him.
Sorry, Cordelia. Saul, this is my wife Cordelia. Cordy, Saul Cohen.
A pleasure, Mr. Cohen. I've met your wife Rachel. She's a wonderful cook.
Saul. And yes, my Rachel knows her way around a hen.
As you were, Mr. Cohen. I just came to rope my husband and bring him back to pasture.
Good grazing, friend Salmon.
Oh, you too, Saul. See you tomorrow.
The Kendalls walked toward their wagon.
You're making friends with him?
Why not?
Well, they're Jews, Salmon.
So?
Reverend Milger says they killed our Lord.
No, I don't know about that, honey. And I'm pretty dang sure Saul Cohen didn't do it personally. Why, his wife made us dinner.
But the Reverend Milcher says...
You know, I'm pretty sick of the Reverend Milcher and his sayings. He's not even a good Baptist. He's not anything that I can figure. And he's trying to run everybody in this group.
He's a good Christian man, Salmon.
Not if he's holding it against the Cohens that a bunch of Romans crucified Jesus nigh on 2,000 years ago. That's just plain stupid. Besides, I like Saul.
But...
Stop being silly, gal. Now get yourself up in the wagon before you wake the whole camp.
Two days out of Bliss, Kansas, Jedediah waved Jason to his side. He'd had a gnawing feeling that somebody was following them, but he'd only just seen the trace of a dust cloud on their back trail. Whoever it was, there weren't very many of them. However, he didn't like anybody riding his coattails, be it for good or for ill. He intended to find out what was going on.
What is it?
See that dust cloud?
There?
Right. Somebody's dogging us. Take a man off the herd and ride back. See what it is they want.
And if they want to rob us and take our livestock?
I guess you'll have to stop them, won't you?
Jedediah wheeled his horse and took off at a slow lope toward the head of the train. Jason sat there a moment, shaking his head. Everything was so cut and dried, so black and white with his father. What was he supposed to do? Just ride back and shoot whoever it was? That would make Papa proud, now wouldn't it? He at last turned his horse toward the herd, which was traveling off the wagon train's right flank. He loped on out to its edge toward Wanamaker, who was riding a sorrel today. Ward reined the gelding in as Jason joined him.
My father thinks we've got company coming up behind. Ride back with me and take a look, okay?
Sure, but I can tell you right now what it is. Buggy. Fella and a gal, and the back's packed full of their stuff, including 3 crates of chickens and a goose, and about 6 pink trunks.
Pink?
Pink.
Red-headed woman?
Yep. Do you know who it is, Jason?
Think so. Come on.
The two men rode down the line of wagons at a soft lope until they left the caravan behind and headed out over the open, empty prairie toward the distant ridge and its thin, skyward trail of dust. Jedediah rode up next to the Kendall wagon and spotted Salmon on the driver's bench.
How's the new rig working out for you?
Oh, just fine, Mr. Fury. Just dandy. She's sure a lot smoother, though I suppose these help.
Salmon pointed down to the folded blankets, quilts, and coats upon which he sat.
You're catching on, Kendall.
Jedediah let Kendall pass him while he looked back down the line. He saw Jason and Ward in the distance, heading back toward whoever was trailing them. He figured it was somebody looking for a little free protection. Probably not Indians, who wouldn't trail them for so long or so openly. The same went for raiders. Anyone counting on doing harm to the group would have done it long before now. No, Jason and Ward would be all right. He dug his heels into his roan and urged it up the line again, past Salmon Kendall, past Saul Cohen's two wagons, past the McDonald rig, and up to the Milchers. Mrs. Milcher and all the kids were on foot, and the Reverend was driving one-handed, smoking his pipe.
Afternoon, Milcher.
Good day to you, Brother Fury.
Why don't you let your two littlest gals ride? They can't weigh much.
No, it's good for them, brother. Children need their exercise, just as young animals do. Makes them strong in their bodies and strong with the Lord. Have you thought any more about Sunday?
I told you before, Milcher. This train doesn't stop for a whole day for anything, not even God.
But the spiritual needs of the men...
You can meet those in your own time. Mine is going to be spent moving this train west.
He didn't bother to say goodbye. He simply let his roan drop back to poor, beleaguered Lavinia Milcher and reached down.
Hand him up, man.
He nodded to the girls, and one at a time, she lifted them up to him.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Fury. They're exhausted.
That's a long walk for a little mite. Hang on tight now.
Jedediah dropped back further to the McDonald's wagon. He wasn't fond of Hamish or his son Matthew, both of whom were on horseback at the head of the train. They were already hard at work establishing themselves as community leaders, Jedediah thought. But Megan was driving their rig right now, and she was as unlike her father and brother as a strawberry was from two sour pippins. Jedediah didn't think she'd mind the two little ones. He was right. She accepted them with open arms and let them crawl back inside the wagon where they could lay down. They were asleep almost before their heads were down on the pillows.
That Reverend, he's just too pious to breathe.
I wouldn't argue that, Miss Megan.
Jedediah gave one last glance toward Jason and Ward's diminishing figures, then rode off to fill in for Ward with the herd.
I told you, lady, you're not welcome. Not you or your gambler friend.
The girl, Abigail something or other, he remembered, stared up at Jason dumbly. The slicker at her side was looking pretty annoyed, though. They didn't even come close to having a proper rig.
But here we are.
That doesn't have anything to do with it. Turn around and go back while you still can.
No.
All right. I'll let you talk to the wagon master.
He wheeled his horse and set off at a gallop toward the train, which was out of sight. Ward came right along with him, and he heard the rattle and bang of an overstressed buggy trying to keep up behind them. He allowed himself a little smile. The jolting ride up to the train ought to knock some of the pioneer spirit out of them. He glanced back just long enough to glimpse the woman holding onto the armrest and seat back for dear life, and the man braced stiffly. Only his feet, pushing against the footrest and his mid-back pressed as if his life depended on it against the backrest, were still. Both of their faces filled with sheer terror, being jolted skyward at any moment. Smugly, Jason urged his mount into a faster gallop. Within a few minutes, they were even with the train and had come up even with Jedediah, who had dismounted and was staring very unkindly at the newcomers.
Get them the hell out of here!
Told them, Pa, but they wouldn't take no for an answer.
That's right, Mr. Fury.
We don't want you...
His father trailed off, interrupting his famous, "We don't need your kind around here" speech, and Jason noticed that his gaze had been momentarily distracted by a passing wagon, Milcher's wagon. And Milcher was staring down at the girl in her spangled dress like the very wrath of judgment itself.
What's your name, boy?
Roman Lefebvre, and my lovely companion is Miss Abigail Crimp. And I am hardly a boy, sir. Although I thank you for the compliment.
None intended. Everybody under 40 is a kid to me. Tell you what, Roman Lefebvre, you fall in behind the last wagon. Once we camp for the night, we'll let the group decide whether you stay or go. Their decision's final. No ifs, ands, or buts. Fair by you?
Delightful. And fair as a Kansas court. And call me Rome, sir.
Jed got back on his horse.
Last wagon, Rome.
Jedediah rode off in one direction, Ward rode off to join the herd, and Lefebvre turned his wagon around to meet up with the end of the line, which left Jason sitting there on his horse, watching the line of Conestogas move on by while he slowly shook his head. The Reverend Milcher took center stage after dinner, just as Jedediah had thought he would. As for himself, Jedediah leaned back against the wheel of his wagon and lit his pipe, getting ready for what would pass as his evening's entertainment.
Now, you all know me, my dear friends. I have brought most of you from the eastern shores of our great country. I have ministered to your needs and seen to your wants. And I say unto you that these newcomers have no business amongst us. We are stalwart and godly men and women, pioneers all. We have no need for spangles and cards, for games of chance and ribald song. And I say, so long as we are cleansing our ranks, we should divest ourselves of the members of the Hebrew race. Let these crucifiers of Christ and these entertainers be cast out together so that they may have each other's company on the return trip. I am not an unkind man, my friends. I would send no one into the wilderness alone.
Brother Kendall!
Excuse me, Reverend, but I don't know what you got against the Coens here. Why, Sol and his Rachel have been good friends to me and mine.
Thus began a heated debate that delineated, for Jedediah at least, the two major camps among his pilgrims. Namely, those who wished to cross the land lugging a cross in the New Testament, and those who just wanted to get there, period. Now the McDonalds, two of them anyhow, were staunchly on Milcher's side. Surprisingly, so were the Wheelers, the Widow Jameson and her brood, and Milt Billings, although as a hired man, Milt had little say-so in the actual proceedings. Dr. Morelli and his family kept their mouths firmly closed, afraid, Jedediah supposed, that if the Jews and the fancy women and gamblers were being picked on now, the Roman Catholics couldn't be far behind. He probably wasn't wrong. When you came right down to it, Jedediah was rooting for the gambler and his woman. Oh, he didn't like them. He didn't have to, he supposed. But it'd be worth the extra bother of taking the gambler along if it knocked the Reverend Milcher down a notch. Jedediah would like that. In fact, he'd enjoy it more than he'd admit, even to himself. They went on and on, these hardy pioneers of his, these escapees from civilized society. They argued and yelled and preached and hollered as if they were debating the course of the world instead of just one lonely wagon train of outsiders, of dreamers. And that was it, wasn't it? No matter what each one thought, no matter from whence he or she had come, they were all outsiders now, outsiders wherever they went. And at long last, the outsiders voted to keep the Coens, to keep the gambler and his woman, and to ignore Reverend Milcher's protest to the contrary. Jedediah had good reason to smile.
Glad that's settled. But one more thing before everybody turns in for the night. I noticed a lot of little kids really dragging today. This is probably my fault for not saying something sooner, but I make it a rule on my drives that all kids under the age of 10 walk only half days. It's too hard on them otherwise. Everybody got that? Lefebvre.
Yes, Mr. Fury, what can I do for you?
You can pay me your share of my fee. That'll be $80 flat.
Abigail hummed to herself as she finished cleaning the supper things. She'd listened to the debates earlier and was more than pleased that they wouldn't have to turn back, although she was more than a little miffed by Milcher's use of the term ribald song. She wasn't exactly sure what that meant, but she figured it couldn't be good, not judging by the tone he'd used. Rome was still up there, talking to the wagon master, Mr. Fury. She'd learned he was the pretty boy's father, and she sighed without realizing it. That was one fellow she'd like to take a little buggy ride with if it weren't for Rome. Oh well, things were what they were. Rome couldn't keep her from looking, though. Suddenly, he was behind her, grabbing her around the waist.
Oh, indeed, Abby. You got any pin money, sweetheart?
There's 35 cents in my pocketbook.
No, you idiot. I mean real money. It's gonna cost us $80 to tag along with this crew. After I paid the hotel and livery, I've only got 40 left, and that's just barely.
Oh, Rome! Really, I don't...
You must have something stashed, honey. Something put by. How'd you buy that new dress? The green one? I sure didn't shell out for it. Now fork it over, or I'll give you something to really cry about.
Ow! In my carpet bag!
That's my girl.
Why do you have to be so mean to me?
Because you don't tell me the truth, Angel.
Roman already had her carpet bag and was dumping its contents out into the dirt. He pawed through her underwear and shoes and stockings until he found her little change purse, the one made out of soft deerskin with silver fittings. He opened it and smiled as he counted out the money.
You've been holding out on me, Abby. $70 even. I'm gonna go pay Fury. You clean up this mess, you hear?
As he strode off, out across the circle made by the wagons, she bent to pluck her clothing from the dirt. And as she did, her tears finally spilled. He'd taken her money, her savings. She'd never be free of him now. At least not before 3 or 4 years more of working in saloons and brothels. She'd been barely 16, orphaned, and living on the street when he found her and introduced her to the life. And she knew nothing else. It was a rough and cruel existence, and she had secret dreams of leaving it behind, of marrying, of becoming respectable. Now she'd be too old for anyone to want her. At least, by the time she saved up enough money to slip out of Rome's clutches. She stuffed the last items into her bag, realizing that tomorrow she'd have to figure out how to do laundry on the move. She looked out into the open circle and saw young Jason Fury talking to another man, the one with whom he'd ridden out to their buggy. Ward something? It didn't matter. The two of them were standing before a fire, and the light washed up over Jason, all golden and warm and enticing. It wasn't difficult to imagine him making love to her, being tender and gentle and caring and nice. Yes, nice. He was looking better and better.